Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by the Tamarack Arts Online String Intensive, which is a summer program that runs from August 25th to the 27th and is designed especially for adult learners of all levels. This program is paced to avoid the fatigue that sometimes comes from learning on the internet. Along with private instruction from their world-class faculty, this year's workshops will include mastering the higher registers, ear training and sight singing, improvising without fear, and new approaches to address the obstacles every serious music student encounters from time to time. Visit www.tamarackarts.org/enroll to learn more. This link will also be included in the show notes, so no need to write it down. The Cello Sherpa podcast listeners get 15% off registration by entering the code SHERPA15 at checkout. Today we're going to do something a little different and have a panel discussion on the tackiest subject of all, rosin. On today's panel, we have our rosin expert, Cameron Robertson, who's the owner of Cameron's Violin Shop located in Atlanta, Georgia. For the past 20 years, Cameron has been working as a luthier, building violins, bows, and creating his own line of violin and cello rosin, a perfect resume for this discussion. Since 2011, Darius Skorachevsky has been the principal cellist of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Darius and I have known each other for about 30 years as we attended the Peabody Conservatory together, where we both studied in the same studio with Stephen Cates. Cellist Peter Garrett is a former student of Brinton Smith and Chris French, who back in season two, they were both guests on this podcast. He's been a member of the Alabama Symphony's cello section for 7 years and spent this last season with us on a one-year contract in the Atlanta Symphony. Lastly, Amy McDougall graduated from the Peabody Conservatory with a degree in flute performance and then attended Vanderbilt University Law School. She's the owner of Clear Resources, our keynote sponsor of this podcast, and was a previous guest on this podcast back in season one in an episode titled Anything You Play Can Be Used Against You. Thank you all so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So right about now, you may be asking yourself, why is there a flutist on this panel when we're talking about rosin? Well, Amy and I have known each other for 35 years, and she played a bit of cello in high school, where we both attended the Interlochen Arts Academy. And for the past year or so, she's been very interested in us covering the topic of rosin on this podcast. So I thought it would be great to turn over the hosting duties to her today, so she can ask three cellists and a luthier anything about rosin.
Thank you so much, Joel. I am thrilled to be a guest host on the Cello Sherpa podcast, and I have been eagerly awaiting this, even though it seems like, again, the tackiest subject of all. When I thought about all of the things that go into reaching expert level of things, there's sometimes unsung heroes on those paths, right? So gymnasts chalk up their hands before they perform, you know, in elite levels, and billiards competitors chalk their cue before they play, and surfers wax their board. And it has always fascinated me because just as shoes we wear meet the earth and literally connect our bodies to the planet, the rosin sits right there where the music is born on the instruments. And so it might seem like something that's kind of mundane and routine for you all, but I thought for younger cellists and for those of us who don't play a string instrument, it might be interesting to hear about the role that this little devil plays in making some of the most beautiful music on our planet. So I'm going to start with our cellists here and ask a few questions. So Darius, I want to start with you and just ask you, what kind of rosin do you use and why? And have you tried other brands, and how did you land on your favorite?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here. It's a thrilling subject to every cellist, I think. We all dream about this secretly, to have this kind of conversations. I actually have been searching for a perfect rosin throughout the years when I was younger. And when I found it, I kind of decided to stick with it. And I have not tried anything else since then. And the rosin I'm speaking of is William Salco, just a dark rosin for, I think, they branded it for violin, viola, and cello. So I really thought that's like a perfect fit for me. And I've been using it for past 25 years or so. I've tried others like Hill and Prostro and Bernardell and Melos and all these other things. And there's always something not fitting. There was usually maybe too much bow noise, too much high frequency, or maybe too low, too sticky. I even tried some bass rosin before. My mom is a retired bass player, but I also know some cellists actually do use bass rosin. Once you use it, it's hard to go back because it's just so sticky and, you know, lovely. But you know, I think it comes with setbacks because depending on your climate, you know, you can't use it in a humid climate or maybe you need drier climate for bass rosin. I'm not really sure. So I went back to cello rosin after a little bit of craziness with the bass rosin and found Salco to be the best fit for me. I'm not really sure why. It's just a really good fit. And I don't actually rosin the bow every single time. It's just a...
It's a feel. So when you say sticky, can you describe a little bit more what that means? Maybe the bow just doesn't flow across the strings in quite the right way, or you can't get the right kind of bow articulation quickly, or like, how would you describe what too sticky feels like?
Too sticky, yeah, exactly like you said. I think when you're playing, you're looking for a certain articulation, variety of articulations that you can easily achieve. The bass rosin or like some sticky cello rosins are basically making the hair last longer on a string in some ways. So then bowings like sautier or fast staccatos or anything like that become more difficult, you know? So some rosins that are a little less dense, I suppose, allow for more flexibility in that aspect.
And how do you know when you say you don't rosin your bow every time? How do you know when you need to again? Is it something that you're hearing or is it more something that you're feeling?
I think it's both feel and sound. Sometimes you just kind of forget when you're in orchestra rehearsals and just don't do it on a daily basis. And then you realize when you have to play something solo, oh, yeah, I need to, when you're practicing at home, for example. So you need to bring it back and just put a nice coat on the bow. So yeah, both sound and feel.
Can you have too much rosin on your bow? And how do you know maybe that you've done that? And how do you clean it off or flick it off? Or how does that go?
I think you can have too much rosin. And it's like, it feels good. And you have this, you produce these clouds of smoke. So like you're on fire when you play, you know, in a way. So maybe that's not such a good thing because then that stuff gets on your cello and on your instrument and then you have to clean it off. So there is a limit of how much you can have. You just have to be reasonable with it.
That's good to know. And so, Peter, I want to kind of pose the same questions to you. I understand from Joel that you actually are the mixologist when it comes to rosin, and there's a cocktail of rosins that you use. So what kind did you land on, and how did you get there?
Yeah, mixologist might be too much praise. I kind of stumbled across two different rosins that I'll do three swipes of Kolstein, and then I'll do a couple swipes of Melos Light. And honestly, I didn't seek these out. I stumbled across them. I used to use the Pirastro rosin, but one time when I was still teaching in Houston, I found a cake of Kolstein that was left over in a practice room. And it was broken too, so I think somebody just abandoned it. And I thought, oh, I've never tried this before. Let me see what happens. And I did a couple swipes on the bow, and I thought, oh, that's great. I'll keep using this. So I used some, like a half cake of Kolstein for a couple of years. And then when I was trying bows in Chicago, I really liked the grip that they all had. And I was trying it at one shop when I felt this, and I thought, I wonder what rosin is on this. And it turned out to be Melos Light. And the person who was helping me try bows said, a lot of people in the area use Melos Light. It's like a Chicago sound. And sure enough, it is a brighter sounding rosin, but there's something about the grip that it kind of compensates for the deficiencies of the Kolstein. Maybe deficiencies isn't the right word, but the Kolstein gets a very dark sound with a lot of depth to it, but by itself, it doesn't grip quite the way that I want when I'm activating the string. And the Melos Light has the opposite end. It's brilliant and it's very quick to activate, and you can get really crisp, clean articulation, but it's missing a little bit of that depth that the Kolstein brings. But I'm sure you could find the same qualities in other rosins. It's just these are the ones that I stumbled across and have kept using.
And you just thought, hey, I'll use a little of this and a little of that, and maybe I can get the benefits from both.
Yeah, well, especially if you rosin your bow before you go in to play cellos or try bows or something, and then you find that there's another bow that feels different, but maybe it has a different rosin on it. Or even if you just are around colleagues who have different rosins and you want to try something, if you've already rosined your bow that day, you're getting a blend either way. So unless you have truly clean horsehair on your bow, you're going to have a blend of rosin on there to some degree. It'd be interesting to try and measure it.
Right. To try different cocktails. And how often do you rosin your bow?
I think about once every 3 days, which seems, I know, Joel, you are like daily. Joel, do you rosin more than once a day?
Sometimes. Depends how much we're playing. Once a rehearsal, I would say. At the beginning of a rehearsal. And then if there's another rehearsal that day, I will rosin my bow again. Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's a lot more than I do. But I think it depends on the rosin you're using too, because the rosin that I use is very sticky right up front, the blend. And it takes a couple hours of playing before it really settles in, so that there's a nice easing into the notes if you want to. I find that if I've just rosined right before rehearsal, sometimes the articulations can get a little bit too prickly, a little too zippy, and it can...
Sound or feel when you say prickly?
Sound. Like I feel like I'm... The crispness of the articulation might be actually not blending with my colleagues as much. So I actually prefer day two of the rosin.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's probably just my blend.
That's a unique approach. I like that. Try a little of this and a little of that till you get just the right amount. So Joel is the obsessive compulsive rosiner.
Yes.
So you say before every rehearsal. And what brand did you land on and how did that come about?
Well, I've been using Melos, but not Light. And I landed on that a few years ago because I spent most of my entire childhood and adulthood using Hill Dark. It comes in a green velvety cover and it was $10 for as long as I can remember. And I watched my colleagues start to buy like $50 and $60 cakes of rosin. And I thought, that's nuts. I'm just going to stick with the Hill Dark. And so I used it all along. And sometimes in the summer, I would switch up and use Hill Light because it's a little less sticky. And when it's humid, stickier can be more challenging. But then ultimately, I was going to Chris, who works at Voss Violins in Atlanta, and I said, hey, can you recommend a rosin that's less dusty than the Dark? Because the Hill Dark left a lot of dust on my cello. And he recommended the Melos, and I've been using it ever since and been very happy with it. I'm not somebody who tinkers a lot. I'm still using mostly the same string setup that I've been using for more than two decades, with a slight variation here and there. And I'm sort of the same. If I find a rosin I like, I'll stick with it. And I don't know that I've ever spent a lot of time listening to how the rosin sounds. I think I'm much more tuned into how it feels. So for me, it's just about when I put the bow on the string, I want to feel the bow catch the string immediately. So I want that stickiness. And obviously, if it's too sticky, you'll get caught up and you can't have a smooth bow. But I find that the Melos has been a great balance of sticky and giving me the control that I need without too much stickiness.
And so what do you tell your students? Obviously, this is important to playing the instrument from the very beginning. And so do you talk to your students about the impact that rosin can have if they're having some bow articulation problems or they're sounding a little weird? Do you talk to them about what rosin they're using and how often they're, or can you hear when they haven't rosined their bow or if there's too much there?
I can hear and I can see that the bow is skating across the top of the string and they're not necessarily getting contact with the string so that it really rings. And a lot of times they start out with a rental cello. They might show up with some really cheap
rosin that comes with wood on the side of it. It's like the thing they stick in every school instrument. And most of the time I'll just let them use what they have until they show up one time and it's not working right. And then I'll pull out my rosin and let them try that and see if they notice a difference. And that's where the rosin conversation might unfold rather than a deliberate conversation about rosin. But I'm sure that Peter and Darius might have different approaches with their students when it comes to rosin.
Yeah, Darius, do you talk to your students about rosin?
I think that's the last conversation one has with students about anything. Or one of the last ones for me, at least. I would usually, as far as equipment goes, you notice very cheap strings. And I think changing strings to something a little bit better, as opposed to changing rosin to something very expensive, or even, I mean, the rosin we're talking about is $20 or less. So it's not such a big expense. But usually the students come with strings that, you know, like you can't identify what they are. So the best thing is to maybe to get rid of those first. And then when the rosin, like Joe, you were saying, like you see the ball skating around the strings, maybe it's time to suggest something. Yeah. And I usually suggest the one that I use because I like it so much. But other than that, that's basically it. The rosin you usually see is the one that you get on Amazon for, you know, $6 for six of them or something like that. So, you know, that's what the music stores usually put in a kits, so to speak, with a cello. So
it sounds like the rosin, although not talked about much, and probably, as Darius said, the last thing to talk about with a student when things are going wrong in a lesson with the music, but it seems like it's a key piece of playing. So if there was no rosin for you three, life would be a little bit different playing. Or if there was only one kind, it seems like that would pose some challenges, either geographically with humidity or just mechanically. So I want to turn to Cameron, our expert here, having heard now these particular affinities for certain feel and certain sound, and just kind of ask about the properties of rosin and how you go about mixing it in a way to have some of these properties. And I would love to know the difference between dark and light. I mean, are we talking like Miller Lite here versus Guinness, or is it just the color of the rosin? So tell our audience a little bit about rosin from the ground up.
Thanks for having me. And this is a really fascinating subject because it does have such a really integral part of the playing process for players. Everything from the tactile feel of how it draws the string to the quality of sound to the texture of the sound. And it's really interesting actually to hear what everybody else has used in the past and how their experiences have kind of let them experiment with new things or try new things or stick with what works. A lot of my experience with rosin actually comes most from working in shops. And I've worked in nice violin shops for many, many years and doing rehairs, and as a bow specialist and a bow maker, and also now, of course, making rosin as well, how we apply rosin, who gets what kind of rosin on their bow, people who have very specific requests for how they rosin, how much rosin, makes a huge impact on the actual playing. So rosin itself is, you know, there's many, many different kinds of blends and tons of brands out there. Like you said, you can go on Amazon, and as easy as it is to find really cheap basic rosins, you can spend $100 on a cake of rosin and everything in between. There's dozens of manufacturers. So it's a little hard to, you can get lost in the weeds of playing around with different rosin types and everything from light to dark to components to different sort of softnesses, depending on like the temperature and environment you're in. And that was something in the shops that we worked a lot with. Joel talks about Voss violins and asking your luthier, what's a good rosin and what's a good recommendation? You know, the bow rehair is going to rehair dozens of bows a day. What do they use? What do they find is the most successful? Sometimes that's a good place to start and see what shops use. We went through and tried a bunch of different rosins in our shops to find the ones that we like. We actually used, when I was working at a shop here in Atlanta, Williams Gengaki violins, we used Milos. That was a rosin that came out that we liked the most. It had the most consistent properties. It had a nice clean sound. It didn't have weird grittiness or tackiness that people complained about. So it was just the most consistent rosin product. And we really liked it. And we used it pretty much consistently for the shop. And I know a lot of other shops have that kind of mentality. They find their one rosin that they like, and that's the shop rosin. Now, of course, I make my own rosin. So that's the rosin I use on all of my rehairs. That's not entirely true, because I will always put whatever rosin the player, if they have a specific flavor that they want, or if they have their own rosin, I'll rehair it and leave it unrosined for them to apply their own, because it's such a critical component to their playing. And if you put the wrong rosin on, like Peter said, you're playing with a blend. If it's rosined even the first time, that rosin will stay on there and it might dissipate over time, but you'll end up kind of combining the effects of the rosin, and maybe the player doesn't like it. So always do what the player wants.
Right. Well, you mentioned that it stays on the bow and the bow makes contact with the strings. I mean, it might seem like a stupid question, but does the rosin stay on your strings too, to some extent?
Oh, yeah. That's the other component of working in a shop, is that rosin gets everywhere, and having the rosin on the string, on the instrument, in the channel grooves for the strings and getting stuck in there, it gets all over the place. So cleaning it carefully, wiping it down, and trying to get it off of the strings is, you know, oftentimes a real problem for players, or you just have to always kind of manage it.
How do you recommend that players manage it to make sure that they're not allowing the rosin to damage the strings or their instruments?
As for the strings, the easiest thing to do is just to use a clean cloth, whether it's microfiber or even like a cotton-like cloth. You can scrub a lot of that off, wipe it off, of course, the varnish on the instrument. A lot of times it bonds to the top, gets really stuck to the top, and needs to be professionally cleaned. And there are certain chemicals that will dissolve rosin without harming the varnish. There are some chemicals that will dissolve both, so you need to be really careful on what you try. And some people at home do try. Getting it off can really damage their instruments. So if you need it really cleaned and carefully cleaned, take it to a shop. There's a kind of a protocol that most shops will follow to clean the instrument carefully to get that off. But to get it off of the bow hair, the best way that I've found is actually just to find a nice fine comb and actually comb through the hair a couple of times. It'll break up the rosin that's in the hair itself and just kind of loosen things up. And some people use a toothbrush. I just use a fine hair comb. You know, I'm bald, so that's the only use my hair comb gets anymore.
Same here.
So that's a good way to kind of break it up. And it seems to help the grip. You get better response from the hair because the rosin gets caked and really bonded with oil and grease and dirt and stuff like that. And that'll kind of break it up. You can use a little bit of alcohol on the strings and on the fingerboard. Don't use alcohol anywhere else, and that will take it off. You have to use really pure alcohol, like a denatured alcohol or even like a grain alcohol. We'll clean it off of the fingerboard and the string, but you want to be careful not to soak it or get too much on there, because the alcohol will actually penetrate into synthetic strings like perlon or nylon, like core strings, and it kind of gets funky in there.
Cameron? With the strings, when you say alcohol, so what about rubbing alcohol?
Rubbing alcohol has a little bit of water in it, I'm pretty sure. That's one of the things that they use to dilute the alcohol. You don't want to get alcohol in the metal strings. So I would use a denatured or a grain alcohol.
Yeah, because I used to clean my strings that way, but then I found that it actually, the strings sounded different after that. So would I be better off just taking some Everclear and stealing that from the liquor cabinet? Would that work and not mess with the properties of the strings in the same way?
Yes. I use a grain alcohol to clean strings and like the fingerboard, just because it's 95% pure or whatever. So it's both more effective and there's also less stuff. It dissipates a lot faster.
Yeah. And I think if we encourage our students to clean their strings and cello every time they play, that avoids a lot of that buildup that Cameron is talking about.
I'm curious to know, without giving away your proprietary mix, obviously, but what is the fundamental ingredient of rosin and what is it that would make it different than other brands? Because I'm hearing different properties. Is this just coming from different, I don't know, trees? Is it coming from different geographic areas? What's the fundamental ingredient? And when they say blends, and when you went to make your rosin, what were you thinking on, hey, these are the properties I want this rosin to have? And how did you get there with the blend?
Well, the main component that you're going to find in almost all rosins is like a pine resin, so coniferous tree resin. And that can come from any number of places. There's all sorts of places that have beautiful pine trees that they can tap and use and get the resin from. So most, oftentimes when you'll buy rosins, it'll say colophony or some sort of French version of colophony that I can't pronounce because I'm not French. So that's the name for pine resin. And that makes up probably 95% of most rosins, but also a major component of almost all rosins are a pine resin. And then you can use other sorts of resins, tree resins, and other things like that to kind of modify that base component of the pine resin. So what I really wanted to do with my rosin was to make a really nice rosin that had nice clear playing properties, but a good grip. I'm a bassist, so for me, anything that's not just like super sticky pops rosin melting out of a red cup seems pretty hard. And that was kind of what I grew up with using was the bass rosins, and they're so soft and they're so sticky. But finding a nice rosin that had those components of clarity, crispness, but also good enough grip. I was trying to make a good universal rosin that would work for violin, viola, and essentially for cello. So it had that crisp cleanness, but a good enough grip to be able to kind of play across all instruments.
Did you need to experiment quite a bit to get to that with different concoctions, I guess I would say, before you got right? What were you aiming for?
Yeah. Again, being a violin maker, one of the things that I did originally was I actually made all of my own varnishes. We started off learning to make like a spirit varnish, which is shellac and alcohol based, but your traditional Italian oil varnishes, linseed oil mixed with tree resin, usually colophony. That's like your standard oil varnish recipe is linseed oil and colophony. So I started getting into this because I was really making my own varnish, and it's really fun to do. You can make small batches of your own varnish at home carefully with fire precautions and knowing a little bit about the components going into it, because it can be hazardous. History has many accidents and dead luthiers who tried cooking their own varnishes in their house.
So don't try this at home, kids, is the message we have on our podcast.
Yeah. Be very careful doing it, because a lot of the components can be flammable. And then when they cook, can also become exothermic, which is the one that, you know, starts to heat itself up. And like I said, we have examples through history of people getting badly injured because they're trying to make their own stuff at home and it lights on fire and explodes. I was making my own varnish for my instruments, and I ended up finally settling on a really beautiful varnish that I'm really happy with. And along the way, I learned a lot about tree resins and different recipes and kind of the properties of a lot of these sort of materials, both in cooking temperature, what changes for how long you cook it, and what some of the things to make as a component for varnish would also kind of translate into making for rosin, because it changes that base of the pine resin. It modifies that pine resin more elastic, softer, tackier.
We had so much more to talk about that we split this episode into two parts. So be sure and catch part two of this interview, which we will release in 1 week on July 7th instead of our usual two-week gap. Thank you so much to Amy McDougall for guest hosting this episode. Thank you to Cameron Robertson, Peter Garrett, and Dariusz Skłodaczewski for joining us today for this rosin discussion. And of course, thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on our guests and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us at @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.